Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, it is Tuesday, and it is Toy Department time. Boys and girls, I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky, and I am once again sitting here in open defiance of my own broadcaster jinx by alleging that we're going to do a short show today.
Come on.
I'm doing it.
All right.
I'm doing it.
Well, we got a shot at it if we don't talk sports.
I'm determined to not talk sports this week. We're just doing we're sticking to the script.
Okay, should we do 2 minutes of sports right now then?
You just try to blow it. I mean,
no,
it's funny because
just...
if you're listening to this, you already know whether or not we blew it.
But right.
We don't
know.
I'm so...
just saying, it's the NFL championship games. You know, conference championships are this weekend.
They are? Shit. Okay, fine.
Buffalo, KC, we don't know if Mahomes is playing. And then Green Bay and Tampa. Tom and Aaron.
I mean, I understand we don't know that Mahomes is playing, and no one is going to say that Mahomes is playing.
But he's playing.
But is there any part of you that thinks he's not playing?
I don't know how messed up he is.
I don't know how messed up he is either. But I'm assuming that if he is upright, he's going to clear that concussion protocol a week later.
I mean, I know
not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's what is. You know what I mean?
My concern, look. He's probably playing, okay? The one way he might not play is if he really, if you get a really bad concussion, sometimes a week later you still, can't look at a bright light. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean,
it's possible he is incapacitated at a level that makes it impossible for him to really function as a starting quarterback.
Yeah, you're right. I suppose there's a scenario in which he is too incapacitated to even fake it. You know what I mean?
Right, but no, I'm not worried about him passing the protocols if he can stand and throw. You know what I mean? So, the odds are he will play. But will he be 100%? Because I think the Chiefs' edge over the Bucks or Bills, rather, and I do have them ahead of the Bills under full health circumstances, but not by a lot. And, a limited Patrick Mahomes could easily be the difference in my mind. So that's interesting, I guess, is all I'm saying. And then the other one, I'm going to take Green Bay, and I'm not going to think too hard about it because I just think they're a better football team based on what I've watched in the playoffs. But I did just pick Tampa this week with no reason other than I'm not going to let Tom Brady hurt me again. So that's pretty interesting too.
But you're setting up for him to hurt you next week.
Yeah. I could only keep that promise to myself for a week.
Yeah. I liked the Bucks this weekend. But I have liked Chiefs Pack Super Bowl from the start of this.
Really? I don't remember what I said.
And I am, I'm still rolling that way.
Yeah, I probably am too, unless there's weird reports about Mahomes towards the end of the week.
Yeah. I mean, look, you'd favor the Bills in a scenario in which Mahomes is not 100% or Henny is playing, but I could still see the Chiefs winning a game in either of those circumstances. So
if Henny starts, I don't know that they beat the Bills. It's hard for me to envision that. All right. Any NBA thoughts? Did you watch all the MLK Day games?
I did. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I have a ton of overriding thoughts other than that it may ultimately work out well for the Nets to have a Kyrie-less period to integrate Harden. You know what I mean?
Will it work out well for Kyrie?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like maybe it's easier to integrate them one at a time rather than all at once. It's right. I mean, it took the Heat I don't know, almost a full season to sort of figure out the three guys and who was going to be what.
And the Warriors.
Somebody's going to have to sacrifice.
But who?
Here.
And that's going to be the question. Who and how? Because I think what we're actually going to see is a lot of Harden and or Kyrie, probably more Kyrie, with second unit players, some of whom are really not even NBA players. I mean, Reggie Perry, I've never heard of him. Have you?
I have not. Not familiar with Reggie Perry.
but we watched him play like 20 minutes yesterday. So they've got depth issues, obviously, after the trade. And I picture a lot of Kyrie and or Harden with second unit guys just jacking. And look,
I could see that. I could also see Kyrie in a Cleveland role, right, where it's like take over the game for 4 minutes at a time.
I don't know.
Run the second unit and then kind of hang out. You know what I mean?
I kind of think Kevin Durant has spent his whole career looking for a place where no one's going to do that except him.
Well, it's hard to say that when, like, Kevin actively sought out Kyrie.
Well, then I think his
and played a role in Harden coming here, right? It wasn't like,
but I think
like, you know what I mean. Like,
his thought process, I think, was these guys are both good passers, whatever else they are, and they can do that when I'm not in. Honestly, I honestly think that's where. I don't know, man. That
I don't know.
Like, all that said, their problem is going to be defense when it comes to the last round or two of the playoffs. They can probably beat almost everybody just by the pure brilliance of what those three guys can do offensively. But I'm interested to see what happens down the stretch of big playoff games against Giannis, sure, but probably something more like the Boston guys or even a Jimmy Butler or certainly LeBron and Anthony Davis.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously that's always been the question for Harden.
Well, also he chokes, but that's a separate thing.
Right. So, yeah. Look,
it's harder to choke with Kevin Durant on your team, man. It's harder to choke when Kevin Durant is there, period.
Yes, although Harden did manage it once, right? So,
well, yeah, I don't know if I would call that choking, but he did lose.
And, you know, I would obviously put it on him. He was the third guy in that.
Yeah, he was a bench player.
But it did happen to them.
It did.
So,
all right. That's enough sports, but we got it in. Six good minutes of sports, seven maybe. and now maybe we can get a short show in.
You're doing your best to sabotage me.
I'm not. That was the shortest sports segment we've ever done.
All right, let's jump into the homework from last week. Is there anywhere that you want to start in particular?
No. They're all. I have no specific preference.
Did you view all of the homework assignments as roughly similar in quality?
No.
Okay. Because I was truly blown away by something this week, and I want to see if it's the same thing that you might have been blown away by.
I really liked
so I guess
things.
Okay.
Well, I mean, look, let's start with Tiger, because I don't know how much more there is to add here. We said last week this is a really good documentary about Tiger Woods, who is not an interesting person, but his story is fascinating. This was equally, if not more, fascinating, the second episode, and everyone who has any interest whatsoever in sports, certainly, but really anyone should watch this documentary. There's so much to dig into and think about. It is an incredible life, and there are some reminders in here both about how truly incredible Tiger Woods was as a golfer and also about how unbelievable his entire rise and fall and really rise again story is. The only person who can compare is A-Rod.
I don't know about the only person who could compare, but I think that is pretty. Pretty incredible.
I mean, it's the only. It's the only other true. Like Jordan never really had that sort of fall. The sheen has come off of his image at times for various reasons and in various ways.
Yeah,
it was never like
that.
I wasn't
necessarily thinking about Jordan or LeBron and the decision. I don't think that's
quite
the same thing.
No.
Although it's like, you know, I was sort of thinking about it because I think some of when you do go back and look at some of the people's reaction to this. You know, some of the just gleeful knives that were out for Tiger, what did he really do? He cheated on his wife, which is, you know, not great, but not exactly uncommon in the world of elite athletics.
And I think
he got a DUI. You know what I mean? He had a painkiller addiction.
It looked really bad.
If Tiger was a rock star.
No big deal.
Instead of a golfer.
Right.
Right? Like, this behavior wouldn't even be criticized.
But
so,
rock stars...
I'm not defending any of that stuff.
Two things. First of all, rock stars don't craft pristine, self-righteous images like sports stars do. So the fall isn't the same. It's sort of part of the game. Like, in sports, the falls for things like cheating, or in politics even, right? Those scandals are big because of the image that the person initially set up. The second thing, though, is, like, anyone else... I was just going to say, anyone else you'd compare Tiger to, just that they're not big enough. There's only 5 or 10 people in the history of the world with the sort of sports ability and acclaim that Tiger Woods achieved. And so anyway, the documentary is really fascinating and I would highly recommend it to anyone.
Yeah. It's weird because I think that going into this, I would have, been more looking forward to the second part than the first. But I actually found the first more interesting.
Well, I think there's more. There's more stuff that you might not have expected to see or hear in the first one, because the second one has a lot of salacious details, but they're all sort of what you would imagine them to be, right?
Yeah.
It's not like any. It's not like you're like, oh my god, another relationship. No, like, you know, he was cheating all over town. He was mixing it up all over the joint, and like. You get some gritty details of that, probably some unnecessary ones, but there's nothing like with the depth or revelation of some of the stuff in the first episode. That said, like, the story continues to be incredible. It's just an incredible story. It truly, truly is.
I think that, and I don't necessarily fault the documentary people for it, because it is who it is. It's just, or he is who he is. We're just never really going to know Tiger Woods on the level of the way you would know a human being, because he doesn't really allow anyone. Like, right? I mean,
do you think he'll eventually
were his like lifelong friends that don't really know him truly as like a human being, you know what I mean? So
not only do they not know him truly as a human being, they pretty much anyone in this has been cut out of his life, you know.
That's what I'm saying, right?
So
like, and they're all kind of mystified by him, you know what I mean?
Well, I think that I don't know how many people in his life do you think are not mystified by him. I think it's probably less than 5.
I agree.
Which is,
I think his mom and children, I think, are probably
but
as far as I go.
Wouldn't you have essentially said that about Jordan 10 years ago? And don't you feel like we know him a little better? I think there is a chance that...
I don't. I mean, it depends on the word essentially. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I think that there are many more people. I mean, I think Jordan obviously is pretty guarded. But, you know, I mean, I think there are a lot of Charles Barkleys and Charles Oakleys out there that,
Barkley's,
you know,
cut
that
out.
Do get to know the real Jordan, or did get to know the real Jordan. Barkley's, you're right. Barkley's cut out now. But
I mean, that's the thing is, like, I don't know.
I imagine there are a lot of people in the Charlotte Hornets organization who kind of know the real Michael Jordan. You know what I mean?
I don't know, like, man. Do you think Jordan and Barkley know the real Tiger? They know him better than we do, right? But I'm just not sure. I don't know that even with Jordan, though, that like the people who work with him really know him. I'll say this. He has certainly become more open as he's gotten older. And I wonder if Tiger Woods will have a similar softening and maybe someday produce his own sort of last dance type thing that, look.
Maybe. Yeah.
Michael Jordan.
I mean, the evidence of Tiger softening was like, hey, he'll joke with other golfers every now and again.
Right.
That's what they got.
But that was, I think you can draw some comparisons to Jordan there, right? Like, early on in his career, all he did was talk shit to everybody. Late in his career, he's like coaching up Kobe on the floor. So, like, I think these things can happen over time. I'm not saying Tiger's going to do this, but I think it's possible that we get a sort of, like, self-produced but somewhat more confessional than we've heard from him before, or documentary from him at some point. And look, I would be here for that, because even if it's only a little bit of insight, I'd love some insight into how he experienced all of this insane stuff.
The documentary that I would like to watch is Tiger Training with the Navy SEALs. I want to know so much more about that. And like
was that just Navy SEAL
process behind that? What happened?
Yeah, so we saw photos of him training, and then we saw videos of people in training. I'm guessing that was just training B-roll video, but it's possible that there's video out there of Tiger doing all this shit, which would be incredible.
Yeah. The other thing, by the way, that I think is noteworthy, because I mentioned this last week, matter of fact, that is, you know, Tiger didn't participate in this, but he kind of did, right? They don't have those shots of him in the car.
And then he sat,
there's an interview clip of him at the end. Like, that's, he had to do that specifically for this.
Because I thought the same thing. And then I was like, but wait, what if that's just something else owned by Warner Brothers?
I'm pretty sure that's, I don't think you could just use that footage, right?
Well, I think it probably depends on how it's licensed. But if it was like licensed to a company owned by the same company as HBO Max, I wonder if they couldn't just use that from like a newsreel or something. Because clearly you can use news footage,
didn't seem like a newsreel, though. That seemed really original.
Well, but that could have been like
footage.
The
photography was really similar to the, right? It had that look that the rest of the film had.
Or it looked like a 60 Minutes feature, you know? I don't know.
A little bit. And, you know, the thing I would say, right, is like, right, like this, you know, the documentary is from the book that Armin Katayan and someone else wrote. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the second guy. Oh. And, you know, that book was well received. And I think that it's not inconceivable to me that they could have gotten him to just do one interview at the end. You know what I mean? It wasn't like that interview was like super probing, right? So
no, but like,
you know what I mean?
I can't imagine he would have done that without some approval over what else was in the documentary. And I can't imagine he would have been okay with some of the stuff that was shared. So I don't know.
No way they got those car shots, right?
Like I said, it could have been it could have been from a broadcast TV news feature. You know, like an interview with Tiger Woods before the Masters or whatever. I don't know.
I guess it could have been, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't. You know, maybe. Just from the look of it.
Maybe.
So,
if that's the case, I don't know why there wasn't more from that.
Well, that may have been all he would give them.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Anyway, interesting documentary. I recommend it.
Yeah, interesting documentary. Again, I like the first part a little bit better than the second one, but I don't have anything, you know, bad to say about the second part. I think I don't feel like it was unnecessary either.
No, yeah,
like you sort of have to, you know, I don't know that this could have been a one part documentary just given the scope of his life.
Agreed.
You know, it is an interesting life, and like, you know, to hear Stevie Williams, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like really get into it.
Yeah.
And I know that's, you know, obviously that's stuff that had been speculated about a lot and he'd been asked about a lot. Like,
yep.
That's something. I don't think I knew that they never spoke again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
it's crazy. The whole thing, that's a bummer, man. That bummed me out.
Best man at his wedding.
Yeah.
Jeez.
That sucks. All right. So since we're ending on a down note, maybe we should talk about the thing that I think we're both going to say we didn't love, which is the Small Axe film, Red, White, and Blue.
Yeah, I did not love it. You know, when we were doing the homework, I was like, maybe we want to take a break from Small Axe. And that is not so much me going, I'm not enjoying Small Axe, because I think it's all really good. I just, it's a little bit more of like
a bummer,
you know?
This one,
it's a lot of struggle, man. I'm in the struggle a lot. I'm in the struggle in real life. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And now I'm living it on TV. So,
this one I thought was the least enjoyable and effective, of the three we've watched. Do you disagree?
I don't, I feel like they're all wrong. Roughly the same amount of enjoyable and effective, if that makes sense. And I get them all as a piece. You know, look, I'm not saying I don't like some more than others.
Right.
But I don't feel like this was remarkably less effective.
Well,
and I think you almost have to tell this story, right? Like, it's not the story of this to me is not dissimilar from One Night in Miami, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, right? You know, it's that sort of tension between those who want to reform the system from within versus those that only see the system as entirely the problem, right? So, you know, and the tension between those two sides and coexisting and all of that, like that, I don't know if you're going to tell five stories about racial relations in that community. Like, you sort of have to have something that has that aspect of it, right? And so,
well, yes, I just thought that this was the second Small Axe film, at the house party, Lover's Rock, was a very, like, you know, just plopped in and yanked out of One Night in the Life.
Yes.
Right? In some ways, it was an incomplete story, but in other ways, that was the nature of the story. It was just one night in the life of some people.
That one's going to be the detour, though, I think, you know, when we look back on all this,
but I'm
right?
saying this for a reason. This movie, to me, just felt like an incomplete telling of a story.
Okay.
Like, it just... Instead of a night in the life, it was like a few years in the life, but where it started and stopped felt so random. I felt unsatisfied at the end, and it was not bad. It was just as well done, and the themes were just as clear and well addressed, I thought. It just left me wanting because it was like, all right, I got like a very weird sort of undefined, unrefined piece of this guy's life. And I kind of wanted to know more about what happened.
Was wanting to know more about wanting more of like the reconciliation between father and son there or... Or, like, you want to know more about what happens to his policing career and whether he becomes a detective or...
Just, like, what's he do... Whether he's able to affect any change whatsoever. Whether, you know, like, I get the point, you know? But I wanted more of a complete story about where this guy's attempts to change things went. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean...
You didn't feel that way at all, I guess.
I didn't feel that way, no. Largely because I didn't have any expectation that he was going to really change things.
No,
right?
I didn't think
he was... He's one cop, so...
No, but it's based on a true story, right?
Right.
And I guess I just thought that true story would involve, like, something more dramatic.
Yeah, I guess. I didn't think the narrative arc was going to be him versus, like, policing. I thought it was going to be about him and his father, you know? So I feel like, to me, that circle was closed enough.
All right.
You know?
Yeah.
Close in a realistic way, I guess, is what I would say.
Well, right. I mean, and I guess that's the issue. Like, this is, it's based on real life, and it's not taking real, like, dramatic liberties with the story to tie it up in a nice way. So maybe that's on me, perhaps, for expecting something different. But it just left me a little wanting, and that's why I think I found it less satisfying than the first two.
Yeah. My take roughly is the same, though, in that I think, like, these are all skillfully made, right?
Yeah.
Like, the acting is superb.
Yes.
Which
do you think has been your favorite so far?
Oh, I still think it's the first one so far. Although I like the second one a lot for, you know, very different reasons. I just feel like the second one is kind of, I don't know, almost just a wholly different story. So, yeah. But I do feel like I need a break because it's just heavy, man. You know? Yeah. Like, they're not – it's not the easiest hang.
No, it is not. And, but nevertheless, we are going to press on.
Yes, we're going to press on and watch some more. Yeah. When we get to homework next week. All right, so should we segue into One Night in Miami then?
Yeah, I suppose we should. Is this the thing you were blown
like
away
said,
by?
It's not the thing I was blown away by. So it pretty much tells you what I was blown away by.
It does. Because
we're out of things after that.
Yeah, but I'm excited.
But I thought it was very good. One Night in Miami.
Me too.
I don't really have any complaints. I mean, it's, you know, this is also much like now I'm completely blanking on the Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. You know what I mean?
Huh.
This is very much a play.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because one of the things I wrote down actually is that I thought it did a much better job than Ma Rainey of turning that play into something of a movie. Now, I'm not going to...
Agreed.
Okay.
100%.
All right. I'm not going to say it's, you know, you can still feel play vibes, but I'm not sure if you're going to do a relatively faithful adaptation, I don't know that you can avoid that. I thought the thing that impressed me as much as anything, and I thought there was some very good acting in this movie, and it was really well written. I you know, it's very talky, but I enjoyed it. But the most impressive thing to me is the direction. I meant to look, and I forget who the DP, the cinematographer, was. But for Regina King, as a first-time director, I thought this was pretty brilliant. Like, she really made use of you know, walking them out of buildings and moving them around in ways that made it feel less like you were stuck in a playhouse watching a screen, which was sort of the effect that Ma Rainey had.
I would agree with that 100%. And that's my point in saying it was a play was I felt like it's sort of written as a showcase for the acting. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But this feels like a movie, whereas Ma Rainey felt like you're watching a play.
Totally. And I think that's a credit to a first-time director working with pretty intense subject material.
Yeah. I thought the performances were I think it can be really hard to walk that line when you are playing extremely famous people.
Okay, wait. Before you go
somewhat
any further,
idiosyncratic ways of speaking, you know what
yes.
I mean?
Okay, so I would like you. So in this movie, we have Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, and Malcolm X.
Yes.
All very famous. I know the least about Sam Cooke in terms of, like, what he was like as a speaker or, you know, I can't, like, picture Sam Cooke on a radio or a TV broadcast or anything. But If you had to rank those performances from those four actors, how would you, what order would you put them in? Like, who was your favorite? Who was your least favorite?
Ali Brown ex Cook.
So your favorite was Ali, or your favorite was Cook?
From favorite to least.
Okay, so I mostly agree, except I think I liked Leslie Odom better than you did. I think clearly the guy who played Muhammad Ali was the best of them. He was awesome.
Incredible.
The guy who played Jim Brown, I thought was good, but I thought the way he was good was sort of by doing the least.
Well, I think that's Jim Brown.
That's part of it, but also just like he was, everyone else was doing some sort of caricature. It felt like, especially I thought Kingsley Ben-Adir, who we like in almost everything, I just thought was a bit of a weird Malcolm X. He was my least favorite.
What did we just see him in as Obama?
I forget, but he was so good as Obama. He was so much better doing Obama than he was doing Malcolm X.
I didn't think they were that different as Obama and as Malcolm X, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's like, sort of the problem, right?
Yeah, obviously the Malcolm, you know, his Malcolm is much more strident, as you know, right, as one would expect. But other than that, right, it was just like, it was that turned up.
Yep.
With the anger turned up a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah.
But the anger felt, I don't know, there was an impotence to the anger that just did not feel very Malcolm X-y to me. Am I crazy? I don't know. I didn't love that performance. Leslie Odom is just
remember, you're getting Malcolm X at this rate. It's Malcolm X at this extremely precarious
moment. At a tender
moment,
place,
right?
Sure. But, yeah. But still, it felt, he didn't feel as convicted as I would have thought he should be. And maybe I just don't understand Malcolm X enough. But, like, it just, yeah, I don't know. He didn't sell it for me. That being said, I really liked this movie. I mean, I thought it was really interesting. I thought it speaks, obviously, to a lot of issues that are still incredibly relevant. And I thought it, you know, it brings up interesting differing viewpoints on critical issues in our country. And again, for a first-time director, I think Regina King did an amazing job.
Yeah. And I think it's, I think it really captures well the responsibility that African Americans who achieve, right, that sort of the weight that gets put on them, and the, you know, and expectations, and how to the different approaches to how to handle that. And I don't know too many movies that have necessarily focused on that.
And that's why, so, for me, like, yes, this was a talky sort of a film, and it felt a bit like a play. But I thought, because the issues they discussed were so interesting and well sort of thought out, I thought it was really, really good. Really good movie.
Yeah. Yep. Me too. It's a definite recommend.
Yeah.
And I'll be, you know, I'm hoping Regina King gets to make some more movies.
Yeah. Well, look, based on the response, I certainly think she ought to.
Yeah. You know, maybe this is a right moment, right? Because this was always scheduled to be an Amazon release, correct? So, you know, maybe the fact that it's coming at a time when there aren't movies in theaters and people are home and it's, you know.
But look, I don't think that really hurts things the way it used to. Like, there's still plenty of buzz about direct-to-streaming stuff these days.
Yeah, although I will say,
or is that just, you know, I can't remember what it was like before the pandemic. Is that what's happening?
I don't know. Well, you know, I think that, and I'll segue to Promising Young Woman with this. I know a lot of people that have, like, heard about this movie and wanted to see this movie and were unaware that they could watch it.
Well, I mean, it just came out like Friday or something. So that's
right.
So crazy.
But it's, you know, it's been, well, it was out, you know, it was at Sundance and it's been out in theaters you know, for whatever that means, right? For a while.
Right.
And I know some people that were, you know, trading it illegally online for a minute.
Right.
And so, yeah, because I've been, you know, since I've watched it, I've been telling people about it because I am really excited to talk about it. And that's a lot of the reaction I got was, I didn't know I could see this. You know what I mean? So
you got to pay $20, but I would say it's well worth it.
Yeah. I watched it twice, by the way.
I wish I had that kind of time because I would have loved to watch this twice before we talked about it. And you know what? I don't know if we've talked about my good friend Jordan Cruciola, Jor Crew on Twitter. She is like a, how do I explain Jordan? She's a longtime Vulture writer, although she's not doing much of that anymore. She's sort of getting into the production side, but in the meantime, one of the things she, I guess she could be described as a wildly devoted fan of certain things to a level that because of her writing and her relative expertise in film and particularly horror or horror adjacent film, she sort of developed a handful of cottage industries about specific films or television shows. Like, she has a podcast about A Simple Favor that blew up. And like she had Paul Feig on, and you know, like it's became a big deal, and now she is the internet's premier expert on the film Jennifer's Body, and she has become sort of the internet's premier promoter and super fan and, you know, presenter and podcaster about Promising Young Woman. So it's hard for me to even envision a world where I was unaware of anything about this movie because she is all over it constantly, and so I see all the think pieces and all the reminders of when it comes out and all that stuff. Go ahead, you first, because you wanted to rave about this.
I am glad then that Jor Crew is not my friend. I didn't think I'd be saying that, but I was delighted to come into this not really knowing anything about it at all. Other than that, I had heard that there was a good lead performance, which is understating it, I feel like. Because it's so, to me, like, it's a movie that grabs you by the throat. It's not quite like anything I've seen before.
Yeah.
I was trying to describe it to somebody, and I said, it's almost like an actionless action hero or superhero movie mixed with romance, mixed with a revenge thriller.
Like, imagine a Quentin Tarantino movie with almost no blood.
Yeah.
That's one way I would describe it, which immediately is a very difficult thing to imagine. But, like, this movie is rich and deep and violent without being really like visually violent. It's so unique. And to your point, Carrie Mulligan, holy goodness gracious, is she awesome in this movie?
Yep. Yeah. And she's in basically every scene.
Yeah. You
know,
basically every,
I should just go ahead. We're going to spoil this.
Yeah. So. Spoiler alert. Do not listen to the rest of this. If you have not seen Promising Young Woman, just go rent it and watch it immediately.
She's in every scene of the last one, right?
Yes. Because of course she is murdered, which was an unbelievable shock. I was waiting for something to happen the entire time, and it is a long time that he is suffocating her. It lasts so long. And
it lasts 2 minutes and 45 seconds.
You timed it.
And the reason I know this
second
is
viewing?
Because I not second viewing. After I watched it, so I started reading about it a little bit, and the director, whose
I can't believe now I'm blanking on her name. We watched The Crown, right? Did you get to any of the Camilla Parker Bowles episodes?
Not really, no.
So Charles didn't have a girlfriend in any of those seasons.
Well, I mean,
or any of those episodes.
He had a girlfriend, but she wasn't really on screen much. And the director is Emerald Fennell.
Emerald Fennell. So she is Camilla Parker Bowles in The Crown.
Ah.
Yeah. And she's
also
briefly
in Call the Midwife. Didn't know that.
She's briefly in this as the woman who's giving the tutorial on how to make blowjob lips. I don't know if you.
Yeah, that's funny. I didn't realize that was the director.
But she, I guess her dad was a cop. So she went and talked to her dad about how long it would take to suffocate someone.
Oh, she's also, she was also the showrunner for season two of Killing Eve. Huh.
Yes. Yeah. Which I liked less than season one, but still pretty cool.
Yeah, still pretty good.
So she actually went and they really tried to figure out how long it could take.
Right.
And that was actually supposed to be the original end of the movie.
Oh, wow.
Her body being burned was basically where the movie was going to end.
That's crazy.
The investors in the movie were like, we've got to come up with something else. So they added the thing at the end. And when you start thinking about how that might actually play out in real life, you can kind of tell that, you know, like the notion that you could schedule text, which that's a thing you can do. We do that at the radio stations sometimes, but that it would somehow time out to the, like that she would know not just that they would be arrested, but the moment that they would be arrested, and that would have definitely occurred during the wedding and, you know,
yeah,
and that the cars
you could
pull up right when the text is in place.
Right. You could definitely plan for the text to be received at the wedding, but not the cops part. But that being said,
exactly. So they tied it up in a little bit.
But I'm glad it ended that way because,
yeah, me too.
Frankly, it's still devastating enough. Like, two women are still dead, right? Because of, like, this asshole. And, you know, he deserved to get his comeuppance. So I'm glad it ended that way. That being said, like, that was still devastating. Like, her getting murdered was shocking and devastating.
In a movie that has a lot of pop soundtracking, right? Like, both 70s pop and then that kind of modern electro pop. That scene is totally silent. Right? Like there's no music happening. You're just sitting with it, you know, for the 2 minutes and 45 seconds and
hoping
with her cries and him freaking out, right? Like
and,
basically.
Yeah. And hoping something, desperately hoping something will happen. Someone will burst in the room, like something, for God's sakes, where she doesn't get murdered by the same creep that led to the death of her friend. And just that sense of foreboding, like that, I mean, in a way, the whole movie is when he's like, this is a guy's worst nightmare, being accused of rape. And she's like, imagine what a woman's worst nightmare is.
Yeah.
Like that's what this movie is personified for, two hours or whatever. And it's so well done. Like you really feel it.
It really gets toxic masculinity in a right. Ultimately it's kind of like, if this is a superhero movie, like toxic masculinity is the villain, right?
Yes.
But like, even in that, right, as he's freaking out, right, and he start like in that kind of like you can tell he's like, right, he sees his whole life going up in flames.
Yep.
Right. And as he's strangling her, right, he's like, this is your fault.
Right.
You know, and later on in the cold light of day, he's kind of like, I'm pretty sure this is my fault.
Yeah.
But even that. Right. Then you kind of get into like, OK, the movie, I think, is gets into this a number of times, and the way that not just that this stuff exists, but the way that people cover up for it.
Yep. Well, here's another thing that I think was done incredibly deliberately. Look at the enabling creeps who surround the characters in this film. I'm going to list them off. Mostly by names associated with other performances they've given. Okay?
Okay.
We have Tammy Taylor, Sweet Annie from Community, Seth Cohen, Piz from Veronica Mars,
yeah,
McLovin. We have a collection of the nicest, nerdiest, friendliest characters in TV and movie history.
Yeah, you forgot my boy from New Girl.
Of course, Schmidt. Yeah. The creep with the heart of gold, right?
Right.
All these people are creep enabler criminals who believe themselves to be quality humans, with the possible exception of Schmidt. He's sort of a dick through and through.
Yeah, he's almost kind of like an unrepentant dick.
Right. Everyone else in this movie who is all the other bad guys believe that they're good guys. Fundamentally.
Yeah, my man from Veep. Yep. You know what I mean? They all say it too, right?
Yep. I'm a good person. I'm not a bad guy. Connie Britton, I'm trying. Allison Brie, like, we were kids, right? They all have reconciled this stuff with themselves. And they're all played by, like, cherished, lovable character actors. That cannot be a coincidence. And I just thought it was brilliant.
I think it was inspired casting. Did you know, this is the other thing I looked up, did you know who played Ryan?
I don't know who that guy is, no.
That is Bo Burnham, who made
of course.
Eighth Grade.
Yes, of course. I did know that. That's Bo Burnham. I've seen him before. And he's another, like, noted nice guy, right? Like,
right.
All of these people, that's it's diabolical casting is the way I would describe it. And I thought it had such the intended effect.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that character, right? Like,
the betrayal of that character.
Yeah.
The fact that he was there, but then the fact that even after all of that, he doesn't tell the cops the truth.
Right. He chose to save himself and save Al, even though
that's
he
right.
loved her. Right?
He loved her, and he really didn't have any love for Al. Like, he
right.
thought Al was just okay. That's just like his med school buddy that he sees sometimes. He really loved her, but he is so attached to, like, the patriarchal society that he can't bring himself to violate the guy code or whatever.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting. And even, like, when you know, you never see this video, but you hear it.
Yep.
And you hear his role in it. And his role, right, like, he's not high-fiving, right? Like, mostly what he's doing is kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
Right.
Nervous laughter. Don't film me.
Yeah. He knows it's
he's
wrong.
He's not like, yeah. Like, you can see the conflict of this is wrong and it's gross, but I need to fit in with
right.
this group.
Yeah.
And him, like, trying to reconcile it almost in real time, which I thought was an interesting touch, because it really would have been easy to just sort of make him one of, like, woo-hoo! You know what I mean, right? So
yeah. No, this movie is not afraid of making this, like, relatively complicated. I mean, at the end of the day, they're all monsters. But
yeah,
but 100%. It's like, but there's different levels, right? And you can almost understand how Ryan thinks he's a good person, right? Even though he's clearly not.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's,
I also, by the way, we talked about casting. Clancy Brown and Jennifer Coolidge as her parents were great.
Oh,
and Molly
God.
Shannon as Nina's mom was great.
Molly Shannon has one scene and is just unreal. Just, like, so emotional. And man, yeah, everyone in this movie is great. This is a great movie.
Yeah, and my favorite scene in the movie was Alfred Molina's big scene. He has more than one scene, but
where he's on his knees.
Yeah, and she forgives him, and it's like, it just, that was like, you know, because you're obviously expecting the scene to go kind of in the sort of Tarantino direction, and it just slaps you with this thing that's the opposite.
Well, that's what's so incredible. That's sort of how a lot of this movie functions, is like from the very beginning, it feels like she's just going to go on a murder spree. But as it turns out, she never really crosses the line in a way that makes her compromised morally. Like, she scares people, but she never puts them in actual danger. Even Alison Brie, right?
Yeah, she's kind of awful to some people.
She's not nice. Don't get me wrong, but she's not. She's never actually violent or truly destructive to people. She puts them in awful situations to try to make them feel the pain, but she doesn't get anyone raped or even assaulted or anything like that. She just makes them afraid. And that's what I think is so – it's easy – look, I love Tarantino. I think he's a totally unique, incredible filmmaker. But on some level, it's easy to just murder everybody.
Yeah. She was going to assault Al, at least. Right? Like, that was, she was just about to do that. So let's
well, we can assume that.
Not to say that she might not have been justified, and she didn't seem to plan on killing him.
We don't know exactly
what
she was gonna do.
She was gonna carve his name into his belly.
Yeah, yeah. And that would have been pretty violent, but still not as bad as it could have been, and she never actually got to do it.
She did not get, well, yes. I mean, she was on his stomach with a knife, right? Like, that was just when he managed to, you know,
I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that's a coincidence, because she never really ends up doing any real damage to anyone.
Yeah.
Like, who did she really hurt? Well, yeah, I mean, people have their feelings hurt, but she didn't physically hurt anyone.
No, not that we see, for sure.
Which is a fascinating approach.
We don't really know what she did to Seth Cohen. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you imagine her having killed him until you see how she handles some other situations, and really she probably just scared him the same way she did McLovin, right? I mean, I think that's what we're supposed to believe.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think that's what happened, right? Obviously, he lived to tell the tale because knew what happened. Yeah,
exactly.
So, like she said, I think it was interesting this movie is set in Ohio, which I think is sort of weird, because they're sort of oftentimes very generic about it, and it's clearly shot in LA. Right. Clearly looks in LA.
Yeah.
So I don't even know why they decided to like name a place at all at the very end. But like, she's talking about how there are women in the city that, you know, go around with scissors, and I don't know how much of that's true.
I think she's making that up as a scare tactic, but sure, she says it, and it does seem far fetched for like Columbus.
Right. Yeah. Like, I don't understand why they didn't just set this movie in LA, to be honest. Like,
well, whatever.
It very clearly is LA.
Yeah. That's the least of my concerns. So,
yes. It does not. None of that ruins any of it.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
But it was, it's really, it's the first movie that I've watched in a while that I'm like, okay, we're going to be talking about this at Oscar time. It kind of jumps out at you as an Oscar movie.
I have a feeling we're going to be talking about a couple other movies we've already seen this year at Oscar time too, but
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's true. I mean, I think we're going to be talking about Ma Rainey, and I think we may be talking about One Miami too.
I think so.
But I didn't have quite that same feeling. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, totally.
It just, like I said, it was really fresh filmmaking.
Yep.
And
it felt really special.
Just delighted by it.
It felt like a special movie. All right, let's get to homework. We can still keep it under an hour.
All right. Look at you. Good looking out.
Yeah.
all right, so we're going to watch Lockdown, which is Anne Hathaway and Chiwetel
Ejiofor.
Oh man, Ejiofor. Thank you. Don't get old. I used to have that one on lockdown. No pun intended.
It's some sort of quarantine heist caper, which interests me.
Yeah, so the reviews have been mixed. It's either love it or hate it. So yeah. We'll see which side we fall on. For that, that's HBO Max, right? Is where you can see that. And we were going to watch the fourth episode of Small Axe, whose name I didn't put down.
I believe it's called Alex. It's the fourth one. Alex Weedle. I think it's he's a novelist, and I guess it's about him somehow.
And then White Tiger, which is a Netflix movie about a gentleman who's trying to climb the economic ladder in India, and starring Mrs. Nick Jonas.
Mrs. Nick Jonas?
Yeah. Priyanka Chopra Jonas, I believe is her name, yes.
I forgot she was married to him. Good for them.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Three movies this week. We're really going movie heavy because there just has not been a lot of TV. Part of that's the season, but I do think we're feeling some of the COVID absence in the television industry.
Yeah, I think that the streamers.
Although I did watch WandaVision this weekend, and you know, it's a bizarre, interesting show that you might not hate.
All right. Well, maybe we'll get to that at some point. I'm probably going to try to check out Search Party season 4.
Before you get to WandaVision, understand.
Which is my next thing. But yeah, I think that because this is historically a time that networks debut a lot of programs, I think maybe some of the streamers are hanging back.
That could be. Yeah, there are a handful of network premieres over the last few weeks that
none of which we feel are worth talking about.
Except did we want to check out the Ted Danson one? The Mayor?
I would do that. That's another one that's gotten some mixed reviews.
Yeah, maybe we'll give it another week or two, build a few up and see how it's looking at that point.
Yeah, I think that may not be a bad idea. Tina Fey's involved in that, though, so that's, you know.
Yeah.
And there's some good people in the cast, so who knows? Yeah, could be good.
All right.
But we've also got a lot of basketball and football to watch still.
Yeah, I think next week.
Although I guess less than the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, but next week we'll be able to have a nice football conversation about two, I think, should be pretty darn good championship games. At least two story-filled championship games, if nothing else.
There's no bummer matchup.
No.
Out there left, right? Like, you're going to have something to talk about either way.
I would say that about this past weekend, you know? Like, it was a pretty good weekend for NFL matchups. They delivered relatively well for the most part, and I'm excited for the championship.
Yeah, I would say that's true. The one thing I would say is, like, how excited would you be if the Rams had made the Super Bowl, you know?
Not all that excited, but right? That was a pretty decent game is all I'm saying.
Yeah, the games were I thought were much better than the previous weekend on the whole for sure.
Yeah. All right, let's not do a whole other sports conversation.
Let's get out of here.
We're about to hit an hour. Thank you. I guess anything under an hour is a short show, so you didn't totally jinx us. Good job.
Yay me! Let's go.
All right, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The lights out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.